Great to see you, man. You've been a hero of mine since the 40s, and I thank you for what I've seen. I want to ask you one question. Do you believe in divine intervention?
I believe what?
In divine intervention.
I don't know, but I believe in a lot of things.
Hey, Bob, as a fellow Century Series fighter pilot, tell us a little bit about test flying the F-100 and how you convinced the Air Force that it was a safe aircraft.
Well, it wasn't easy. Some of the Air Force test pilots were friends of mine enough to where they came by my home for a visit, and they said to me, the F-100 is about as blind when you're coming into land as it is going down your driveway, which went very steeply down. They said, we can't accept the airplane because we don't think it has enough satisfactory control in the low speed range at high angles of attack. We did not have flaps on the first airplanes, and it did have a very high angle of attack. And the Air Force test pilots were saying, we're going to put thumbs down on the airplane. And so I went to the general in command, and I said, if you think about landing on one wheel and 45-degree swept wing, if I were to put weight on that one wheel at the angle it would be sitting or flying along at that speed, it would take the rubber right off of the tire on that side. And I said, we've got, I think it was about a 12 or whatever number of inches that the strut had in travel. I said, if I can fly this airplane on one wheel for 15,000 feet and come back in and have new tires, you will know very well that the airplane is controllable at low speed. He said, why, there's no question about it. And so that's what I did, and it changed the whole situation, and they went forward with it. And then we later did put flaps on it. But I had a lot of trials and tribulations with the F-100. I lost two airplanes in that program. The first one was going up to fire the guns for the first time, the new cannons, and the concern there is not snuffing the oxygen away from the inlet and creating an engine failure. And so I was on the range up, heading for the range at Inukern, and I had a violent explosion fire coming out of the nose of the airplane. And this engine had never been flown in any test rig that was airborne, like many of the engines were tested on bombers. As a result, and I didn't know it at the time, but it was just one explosion like right after the other. It was about like sitting on an 88-millimeter cannon. I mean, real loud bangs and big balls of fire coming out the nose and going by you. And I called our control room where the engineers were monitoring the flight, and I said, I think I might have a fuel leak, and I'm at altitude, and there's not enough oxygen to set off continuous combustion, and the fuel must be going onto the engine and creating these explosions. And I mean, your feet would jump right off the rudder pedals with every one of these shocks. And for anyone who's ever flown an F-100, and I'm sure you remember those conditions, well, the airplane, everybody had said you can't survive a dead stick landing, power off landing, because of the high angle of attack. And a dear friend of mine by the name of Dick Johnson was testing the 102, and he lost his engine, and when the nose came down, it broke off, and he was broken up pretty bad. But I learned a very serious thing from Dick after I went over to see him in the hospital. I said, what does it feel like? He was there in the bed with a broken back, and his feet were uncontrollable with the shakes. And I thought for sure he'd be cripple the rest of his life. And I said, well, what did it feel like? And he said, well, it felt like an orange or a grapefruit right where the thing fractured. And the doctor walked in about then, and he said, that's nature's way of protecting the spinal cord. Well, on this F-100 glide flight, everybody kept saying, you got to bail out, you got to bail out. I said, no, I'm an airplane flying beautifully, and I've got hydraulic pressure, and I'm going to put it on the lake bed. I've got plenty of altitude. And so I set up my approach, and all the way around, everything looked good. And they said, well, we're sending out the fire truck and the ambulance. And I said, don't bother. It's a piece of cake. I've got it made. And about that time, the flight controls froze. And I was doing 280 knots. Now, that's 300 miles an hour. And I couldn't change my angle of attack. And I flew right into the ground. And when I came to and looked up, the airplane was banked about 40 degrees and right wing low. And when the next time it hit the ground, that wing caught, and it pinwheeled across the lake bed. And I was unconscious from that point on until they chopped me out. And they said, how bad are you hurt? I said, I've got a broken back. And I said, get a doctor, get a crane, and lift me out in the seat and let the doctor take care of me from there on my any movement of my body. And so they did, and they took me over to the hospital, and they x-rayed this way and from the back. It didn't show any fracture. And so he said, get up and walk out. You just have a sprained back. I said, no, doctor, I've got a broken back. And he said, well, you can call it whatever you want to, but I can't, there's nothing shows up on the x-ray. And so I then called, had one of my people call the company, and I said, send the DC-2 up and pick me up and notify the flight surgeon that you're bringing me back to L.A. And he met me, and we went to another hospital down there, and they x-rayed me from the side, and had I moved, I would have been paraplegic from here down, because the fracture started up here and went at an angle all the way down my back. And so that's the fortuitous thing about having heard that story from Dick Johnson about what it's like to have a broken back. So it really saved my neck. The next airplane I lost was doing the spin test of the F-100, and we knew it was going to be very difficult to recover, but it was necessary to prove this that it met the specifications. And I'd worked out a procedure of changing the flight control positions every four turns. And nothing happened. Nothing worked. And I pulled the drag chute, and it just flopped around in the back. And I got rid of the canopy trying to get some kind of airflow. And I was sitting in the airplane coming straight down like this, rotating, and no air in the cockpit. I mean, it was just falling vertically. And I ran out of know-how and courage at the same time, and I punched out, and I got a good shoot, and I was floating down. I was looking at the airplane as it was spinning until it hit the ground. And on its way down, I said, don't stop turning now.
Yes,
I tell you why, because some bailouts, not that I've had, but others, the airplane would recover because of the weight distribution. You got to change that gyroscopic effect. Nevertheless, we lost that airplane, but we lost another one too. Somebody else was flying it, thank goodness, but he wasn't hurt at all either. But it did look pretty dangerous, because as I floated down that parachute, I was over a Joshua tree forest on the desert, and I could see those thorns sticking out of those Joshua trees, and I could picture right where they were going to be. But it's good fortune would have it, the parachute covered the Joshua tree, and I hit the sand off to the side of it.
I saw a picture of you losing your flight helmet doing some flight test landings. Can you tell us about that?
He said he had a picture of you losing your helmet during some test flights. After you landed.
I was testing I did carry a suitability work, which was an interesting aspect of flight testing, but I'd have to land on a imaginary carrier at the Inukern test facility, and it was shaped like a ship, and he had cables across it so that you could grab the wire with the tail hook. We had a newly designed tail hook that had never been used before, and when you would catch that cable at 135 knots, it was a pretty smooth situation as long as you were near the center of the cable or the deck. But in testing it, you had to do the worst things that could ever happen to anybody in the cockpit, the dumbest pilot in the world. And so I had to hit an off-center engagement, and these off-center engagements were so severe, the airplane would keel up on its side like this and drag the wing on the runway, which was a wooden deck, and my helmet would go off and down the deck on every landing, and that's eyeballs out, and it's pretty sudden.
Bob, I enjoyed your book. Could you retell the story about your introductory flight in the Stearman with your flight instructor when you went to pilot training?
You want to repeat that?
Your introductory flight in the Stearman during flight training.
Oh, thank you for asking. This fellow's name was Bartow, and on my first flight at primary flight, I had a lot of experience when I joined the service. I started flying at 16, and at 18 I was in the service, and that gave me a lot more money to buy flying time, and so I had become proficient with aerobatics. And so on this first ride, he was just giving me an orientation flight, and he said, "Would you like to see a slow roll?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he did a slow roll and dished out of it. And he said, "Would you like to try one?" Well, I hit it right on the point. And he said, "Where in the world did you learn to do that?" And I said, "Well, I taught myself because there was nobody to teach me aerobatics." He said, "Well, what else can you do?" And I said, "Would you like to see a four-point roll?" "A four-point? What is a four-point roll?" So I showed him a four-point roll. And he said, "What else can you do?" I said, "Well, I can do an eight-point roll." And so... But, you know, as you slow down, your rate of roll is slower. So you have to start with a higher angle of attack. So you go right up to the top speed you could get and then pull your nose up like this, because the first two stops are going to be, you'll have enough control, lateral control, to make it happen. But then you hit the apogee and you start down and you do the rest of them coming out. And I did that for him, and I was always at the same altitude above where I'd started the maneuver. And then he wanted to see loops and all that stuff. We got on the ground, and he was just shaking his head. And I learned this later from him. He went into the commandant, and he said, "I've got a problem with one of my students." And he said, "Well, just wash him out." He said, "You don't understand. He can fly better than I can or any instructor we've got here."
Mr. Hoover, about 50 years ago at Niagara Falls Airport in New York, you were there doing an air show, Saturday and Sunday, I think it was. As a 12 or 13-year-old kid, I was there flying model airplane competition. And of course, you were always sitting on the wing of the airplane, and I spent hours and hours sitting there listening to you talk to people. But one of the evenings, I got into the hangar and was walking around your airplane, and I saw both the wingtips dented on the airplane. And the guy that let me in was there, and I said, "What happened to the wingtips on the airplane?" He said, "Well, when Bob does his roll on takeoff, sometimes he's just a little bit too low and scrapes them up." And I have wondered all my life, if that's a true story, if he was just kidding, a little 12-year-old kid.
Was he kidding or was that the truth?
No, that was not the truth. What it amounted to is sometimes I would be doing those one-wheel landings where I'd go from one wheel to the other back and forth. And a lot of times I would come in and land on one wheel and then pull up and take off, leave the gear down, and come right out and land on the other wheel and take off again. And on some of those, I did. The Air Force accused me with the F-86s of trying to keep our company in business replacing wing tips. But they had 35 degrees of sweep, and the F-100 had 45 degrees of sweep. So it's not as easy as like a Mustang, where you got your wing straight out there and you can see it. But I did skin them up a few times, but it's fragile and just no effort at all to put a new one on.
Bob, I've got a question for you. It's been a long time since I've seen you. I was a lot younger last time I saw you at Reno, but I'm John Bagley's son, Sean. And I've got about 10 hours in the Mustang now, and I'm just as honored as can be to be here in Old Yeller, to be sitting right next to you here today. When I was getting ready to fly Old Yeller, Dad said, now, Bob said, do not spin my airplane. Because one time it'll come out in one turn, one time it'll come out in seven. So do not spin my airplane. Like I said, it's the greatest honor I could have to be here today in your airplane. I'd just like to ask, if you'd have one word of advice for me, what would it be in flying your airplane?
Well, I guess I've always preached the same thing. Know your ability and know the capabilities of the airplane and their limitations on each. And if you know your limits and you know the airplane's limits and can stay clear of them, you can live for a very long time.
We want to thank all you folks for coming. Our time is out, and Bob will be over in the EA Warbirds building over here. And if you'll just try not to stop him on the way, let him get into the Warbirds there so he can do the preparation. And thanks again, folks. I really do thank you for coming.